All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning. We are here on case 12-1611, State of Ohio versus Douglas Wine, for the appellant, Mr. Zahner. Before you begin, I'd like to obviously comment on the absence of Justice Landsnagar this morning. She is watching us from Toledo, and she will be participating in the deliberations at conference later. So, proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Chief Justice O'Connor and other justices. My name is Lauren Zahner, attorney for the appellant. I hope to reserve approximately 5 minutes for any rebuttal of the state's argument. This is a case about fundamental fairness, due process of law under the Ohio Constitution, and a fair trial. The effects of the court's decision has had great effect on Dr. Douglas Wine with his conviction. And in reviewing the appellee's briefs, one would wonder why this court even accepted this appeal. And obviously, the court has strong reasons for accepting this appeal, because it's a rather unique issue that really does not appear to have been decided by the Ohio Supreme Court. And that has to do with whether or not a defendant has a fundamental right to have an all or nothing defense in arguing his case. In looking at the justice system and the powers of the various people involved with it, starting with the prosecutor's office, they have, and the state has, full authority to decide what charges they're going to file. When they present a case to the grand jury, they should have had the opportunity to review their case, review their witnesses, and decide what to present to the grand jury.
What do you think the purpose of submitting a lesser but included offense charge to a fact finder is?
Well, it has a number of things, including whether or not the defendant might be found guilty of something less than what he's originally charged, potentially preventing injustice to occur that a guilty...
Isn't the purpose to prevent a miscarriage of justice?
Yes, but the question, Your Honor, is who makes that decision? Is that a decision the court should make?
Of course.
The prosecutor should make, or the defendant should make?
Why do we leave that to a party?
Your Honor, the party defendant has a number of rights. Those include whether to plead not guilty, whether to plead guilty, whether or not to accept a plea bargain or not to accept a plea bargain, whether or not to testify or not testify. Those are fundamental rights that the defendant has. When the court looks...
When we try lawsuits in this state, we give the opportunity to the litigants and their lawyers to submit jury instructions to us, and those can come to a court. We don't let them just charge the jury with whatever they want.
We
submit that to a impartial, independent tribunal, and that jurist makes a determination as to the appropriateness based on what the evidence is in the case, as to whether that instruction should or should not be given. And then that's reviewed by the appellate courts.
Your Honor, I agree that the judge ultimately makes the decision as to what lesser includeds potentially should be given
some
to the jury.
Some may fall within the ambit of what the evidence is, and some may fall outside. And that determination isn't for a litigant, it's for a judge.
I agree 100%. The judge has to make the decision as to whether or not a lesser included instruction should be given. I agree 100%, Your Honor. However, the defendant has a substantial, substantive due process right to make the decision as to whether or not that instruction is given to the jury, especially when the defendant is taking the position of an all-or-nothing defense.
Counsel, who is the beneficiary of lesser-included offense instructions?
It could be the state. It could be the defendant.
So it's dependent on the evidence, and it's dependent on the facts of the case.
Absolutely.
Okay, so there is no, but what I hear you say is that the defendant almost has a right to demand that the judge permit an all or nothing defense. That is something that cannot be questioned.
Your Honor, when you're looking at defense counsel and the Strickland test and ineffective assistance of counsel, defense counsel and the defendant have a lot of power in making decisions as to how a case should be proceeded.
So it should be trial strategy in your mind?
Absolutely. It's
and
trial
if
strategy.
The trial strategy and you roll the dice and you go for the indicted offense and you do not want to risk the benefit, in some cases, of a lesser-included offense, that is trial strategy of the defense, and it should not be disturbed. Is that your position?
That is our position, Your Honor, yes. Just like the decision whether or not to have a defendant testify, whether or not to accept a plea bargain, whether or not to have...
Well, the question I have is, additionally, is the jury instructions were... that came directly from the trial court. They were not asked for by either the prosecutor or the defendant in this case.
That is correct.
And if the judge is the is responsible for jury instructions, not the parties, and it's one of the duties of a judge in a trial, you know, one of the more important duties in a trial of a judge or for a judge, so... Why is that not incorporated into the duty of the judge to make sure that the jury has all of the instructions that they need in order to, quote, do justice?
Judge, once again, it is our position, and we believe Clayton stands for that situation, that allows the defendant to, the court has to decide the law. The court has to look at what law should be applied to this case, and whether or not instructions, the court has the power to give certain instructions. But it is our position, and we believe under Clayton, that, and even looking under State v. Thomas, when it talks about looking in the light most favorable to the defendant, who makes that decision? Should it be the court that makes the decision, or it should be the defendant that makes that decision? And it's our position, the defendant should be the one who decides how he wants to try the case. The court shouldn't do it. The state shouldn't do it.
It's not the defendant's case, though. It belongs to the parties, and the court's in charge of that. To be sure that parties are treated fairly and equally.
I agree.
And as a case gets indicted in a criminal context, anticipated evidence may come as a basis for whatever that indictment is, say a murder case. But once a witness gets on the stand in the light of cross-examination and the attention focused on the case, sometimes the evidence doesn't come in just the way it was scripted. And why doesn't the state have the right then to say, Your Honor, we would ask for a lesser but included in conformity with what the evidence is in this case? Why doesn't the state have that right?
Because, Judge, the state has the power to indict. They're the ones that present the case to the grand jury.
Of course they have the right to indict. And that's why we have a grand jury. Mm-hmm. And based on anticipated evidence, that's what it would be. But once the evidence is presented in a courtroom, doesn't the court have the obligation to assure that the instructions that go to the jurors are in conformity with what the evidence is in the case? Not what it could have been or might have been, but what it actually is. Isn't that the role of the judge?
Judge, Your Honor, It's the judge's role to make sure that those instructions are potentially offered to a defendant and to the state. But it's our position that it's
a potentially offered.
Well,
I guess the question is, does the state of Ohio, in your view, have the right to ask a judge for a lesser but included offense instruction?
They absolutely have the right to ask, as does the defendant, as does the court.
And who decides if the state and the defendant both ask for a lesser included? Who do you think is the decider, the defendant or the judge?
If the request for a lesser included is asked for, absolutely it's the judge's decision as to whether or not it should be given.
So your objection here, I mean, the basis or the core is the fact that this was sua sponte by the judge as opposed to requested by either side.
Correct.
What would your position be, hypothetically, if there was a charge and the evidence suggested that there was not going to be the support for the charge, the higher charge, and the judge, instead of giving a charge, dismiss. You don't have any objection when a judge dismisses I'm trying to think of a situation where it would be to the benefit of the defendant to have a lesser, the obvious benefit of the defendant. Here, you wanted, or your client wanted to roll the dice, and it had to be a all or nothing, but you have to agree, in some instances, it is to the benefit of the defendant to have a lesser included.
Judge, I agree. But it's also may be to the benefit to accept a plea offer from the prosecutor, which could be a substantial benefit to him. And whose right is that to make that decision? It's the defendant's. And it's our
position.
But
I don't know why you are equating the taking advantage of a plea offer as the same as a jury instruction.
Because it's our position under fundamental fairness and due process, it's the defendant's right to decide how he wants to try his case and how he wants to defend his case.
Okay, well, yes, it is the defendant's right on how to try the case once you get into, but the defendant can't force a plea deal.
True.
You know, so that takes, you know, both parties to agree, the state and the defendant to agree, and then, of course, the judge to accept that. But in this situation, if a judge offers lesser included offense instruction over, was there an objection at trial?
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
Can this be viewed as the judge being less than impartial? In other words, helping out the state's position?
It's our position, yes, it was in this case specifically, and it allowed the jury to make a compromise decision. And it's our position that if, in fact, the case went to the jury only on the rape case, especially since the Court of Appeals demonstrated there was no issue of force that the court could find, Dr. Wine would have been acquitted, and that's what we're asking in this case.
And to follow up then, if your client had been convicted, would there be some issue with respect to ineffective assistance of counsel in failing to request this instruction? Or does a court have an obligation to conduct a colloquy at the time that there is no request? How far do you take this, according this opportunity or this right, as you're asserting, to the defendant?
Judge, I think there should be a colloquy with the defendant by the court, just like there is.
Has that been done, to your knowledge, around the state?
I don't know.
Request or lack of request for these instructions?
Well, there's certainly arguments that have been made as to whether or not lesser included instructions should be given, but I can't tell you if it's.
You think that could give rise to ineffective assistance if a defendant were convicted in that case?
Absolutely not. It's a trial strategy decision, and I don't see any way that the court would say that's ineffective assistance.
Thank you.
So you have no argument, though, or your position is if one party in this situation, if the state had requested that, it would be perfectly appropriate over your objection or your client's objection to have instructed?
It's our position, no. I think the last resort is still the defendant as to whether or not they're going to accept it to allow an all or nothing defense. But in this case, it was never requested by either side, therefore the court shouldn't have given it.
But so you're saying that the defendant has to agree to a lesser included instruction?
That we believe under fundamental fairness and due process under the Ohio Constitution,
but
that's correct.
That's not the law in the state. The cases that have looked at that don't say that here in Ohio, do they?
They don't say that, but they're mainly making the decision as to whether or not the lesser included should be given based on the facts and circumstances. But they don't really address the issue as to whether or not who ultimately makes that decision and whether or not that should be the defendant's, and it's our position that's what it works.
But that has been argued in cases before that that over the defendant's objection, the lesser included was given, and the inclusion of the lesser included in the jury instructions has been sustained by the Court of Appeals and by this court.
That's correct, Your Honor, but we believe this court took this case for a reason. And I believe, based on what we've presented in this case, the lesser included should not have been given. And the court can limit, obviously, its decision to the facts of this case.
Well, because this is what I look at this case, and I said what I'm concerned about is this was done sua sponte by the court, not over the objection of the defendant, because I think we've already resolved the fact that jury instructions can be given over the objection of the defendant when the prosecuting attorney is asking for it, and the same way, you know, vice versa, you know, and that has not been deemed to be a reversible error. But in this case, what makes this unique, in my mind, is the fact that it was it was not requested by either party, and it was the judge, based on the evidence presented at trial, saying, I'm going to give this lesser included, and then there was an objection by that's the very discrete set of facts here.
Which is why this court's decision can be limited to the facts of this case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, wait, before you leave, Counsel, I'm on your right. That did raise a question. Maybe I'm confused here. I don't think I've ever been in a trial where the judge didn't say, I'm going to be charging in the morning, and this is the charge I'm going to give. And those charges are always coming from the judge, aren't they?
Absolutely. Of course, either side has a right to propose certain instructions.
Right. Well, the court will invite you to add or detract from what the court's planning on charging. But the charge always comes from the judge, does it not?
Absolutely.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean that either side doesn't have a right to object to a certain charge that is given.
Fully understand. Fully understand. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, on behalf of the Attorney General, I will be taking 10 minutes of the appellee's time and reserving 5 minutes for the County Prosecutor, Edwin Pierce.
What is your name?
Eric Murphy, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
Eric Murphy, State Solicitor.
Thank you.
Mr. Pierce tried this case, so he will focus primarily on any record-based questions that the court might have, and I'm going to focus primarily on the legal issue that the case presents. In defendant's proposition of law in this case, he asserts that the criminal defendants have the right to maintain an all-or-nothing defense as a matter of trial strategy, thereby providing them with effective veto power over a trial court's contrary decision to give a lesser-included offense instruction. We think the defendant's argument in this regard is unprecedented. It conflicts with Ohio statutes and rules, which have long given trial courts the discretion to give lesser included offense instructions when they think it's appropriate. It conflicts with numerous cases, both within and outside the state of Ohio, which have suggested that trial courts can give lesser included offense instruction even over the defendant's objection.
Counsel, it's this question I asked opposing counsel. If a judge sua sponte decides to instruct on a lesser included, and there's a conviction on that lesser included, can that be recognized or perceived as giving the prosecution, the state, a leg up in the trial?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it goes back to what Justice O'Donnell was talking about the judge is the ultimate authority on deciding what the law should be as the evidence has been presented. He looks at the evidence that has been presented, and then he determines what the jury should learn about the law. And when the evidence presented actually suggests that a lesser included offense instruction is appropriate on the standard that this court has established, meaning that the evidence could reasonably suggest that the defendant could be acquitted of the greater offense but convicted of the lesser included offense because of the different, there's an element reasonably in dispute, then the judge can make the determination that the lesser included offense instruction is appropriate. And I think it dates back to even this court suggesting under the statute that allows for lesser included offenses, RC 2945.74, that the trial court actually has an affirmative duty to provide lesser-included offense instructions when the evidence suggests that those instructions are appropriate. So I think that the court in this case, as Justice O'Neill was suggesting, that it was looking at the evidence that was presented, it suggested that the evidence reasonably supported a couple lesser-included offense instructions, and it thought those were appropriate. Now, the defendant then
objected. Counsel, what about the argument you're facing this morning, though? We're being asked to plow some new ground in Ohio here, that a defendant has an absolute right to say, nope, I'm going for all or nothing. You got to convict me of what you charged me with or send me home.
I think that argument is fairly unprecedented. I know that it's been
no question.
It's been rejected by several. I wouldn't say it's new. I don't think it's been presented to this court, but several district courts have rejected it.
And I'm asking you, what do you say to that?
I think it's mistaken. There's no support for it in the court's case law. There's no support for it in the statute that suggests that defendants may be convicted of lesser included offenses. The statute does not provide anywhere that the right resides with the defendant. And I think it's inconsistent with the reason that the lesser-included offense doctrine came about. As the court said in DeAnda just recently, the lesser-included offense doctrine came about actually to benefit the state. It's evolved so it provides benefits to both parties, but historically it existed to benefit the state. So it would be turning the lesser-included offense doctrine on its head to say something that was created to benefit the state now applies only to benefit the defendant when he wants to have the lesser-included offense
counsel,
instruction.
Counsel, how would you respond to Clayton? That's one of the cases that your friends on the other side rely on, and I think it's specifically footnote 2. Can you address that?
Sure, Your Honor. So footnote 2 in Clayton, I think it simply says that a defendant has a right not to request a lesser-included offense instruction. He's taking it one step further to suggest that a defendant has a right not simply to not request a lesser-included offense instruction, but also to affirmatively object if the trial court or the state thinks the lesser-included offense instruction is appropriate. And I think
courts... the defendant would always have the right to object to it.
Yeah, so...
The argument here is whether or not the defendant has the right to block it.
Exactly, and I don't think Clayton supports that because I think Clayton only says that a defendant has a right not to request a lesser-included offense instruction, and it was dating back to the idea that a trial court has a duty to give the lesser-included offense instruction, and if a trial court has a duty, the argument in Clayton was the lesser-included offense instruction was not given there, so on appeal, the defendant was saying, well, it was either plain error because the trial court had this duty, or it was ineffective assistance of counsel because he failed to request this jury instruction. And in that procedural posture, which I think is very different from this procedural posture, because in that procedural posture, there was no lesser-included offense instruction given, and the defendant on appeal was actually affirmatively seeking the lesser-included offense instruction and saying it was error not to give it. In that context, the court was saying, no, you can, as a matter of trial strategy, decide to not affirmatively tell the court that you think a lesser-included offense instruction is appropriate. And then if you do that, on appeal, you can't claim that it was error that he didn't provide this instruction.
What about surprise or disadvantage of the defendant if there is the lesser included instruction? Is there an argument, and I think that has been made in maybe DeAnvere or one of the other cases, that they weren't prepared to, it wasn't part of their strategy, and it wasn't they were surprised by the at the very end of trial that this was going to be an instruction to the jury.
Yes, Your Honor. I think DeAnda essentially rejected that argument because DeAnda says counsel knows, as long as it truly is a lesser included offense, counsel knows that the indictment, the greater offense, includes all potential lesser included offenses. And that's exactly what this court held in DeAnda, or said in DeAnda. So taking it to its logical conclusion, you should be, the indictment puts you on notice not only of the greater offense, but also of any potential lesser included offense.
Well, in this case, it was the difference between sexual conduct and sexual contact?
Yes, Your Honor. The difference was essentially a penetration between sexual conduct and sexual
right,
contact.
Right. So there is no potential for surprise here because obviously all conduct has contact. So it's not.
That's exactly right. And actually, in opening statement, the defense counsel said that the issue in this case is not only about whether the events happened, but also about whether penetration occurred, which would suggest that he might be raising some type of defense on penetration, which would make lesser included offense instructions even more appropriate because that is the element that rape has that gross sexual imposition doesn't have. And so if that element was put in dispute, it makes the lesser included offense instruction.
But just shifting the attention to the evidence that was presented at trial here, there was no equivocating on behalf of the victim that it did occur. There was penetration.
The victim testified to that, but
There was no contrary evidence that would have suggested that she was mistaken.
But I think this falls within what the court said in State v. Solomon, that where the evidence might be ambiguous on the point, even if she wholeheartedly suggested that there was penetration, that a lesser included offense instruction could be appropriate. And I'd point the court to paragraph 18 of the appeals court decision where they suggested that, well, she did suggest that there might be difficulty with respect to penetration. And I think the trial court even relied on additional evidence suggesting that it might be appropriate. The trial court, I believe record page 552, looked to the video evidence that came in where the defendant suggested that something must have happened, but he didn't know what. That could reasonably be concluded that there was some type of sexual contact that happened, but not sexual conduct.
And in the end, wasn't one of the statements that the mother was not a liar? Was that
exactly? That was in evidence as well. So I think at day's end, though, this is just a discretionary decision by the trial court about whether there was sufficient evidence for the lesser included offense. And of course, the test is whether there was sufficient evidence that the jury could acquit on rape but convict on gross sexual imposition. And on the facts of the case, I think they got it exactly right. I'd like to finally end with Beck v. Alabama. The defendant relies on Beck, the U.S. Supreme Court case. And I think Beck is distinguishable for two reasons. Number one, it was a capital case, and most courts have not extended it to the non-capital context. And number two, I think it conflicts, that the defendant's argument here fundamentally conflicts with the reasoning of Beck. Beck suggested that a defendant has a right to have a lesser included offense instruction in circumstances where the evidence might suggest it is appropriate because Beck was worried about the situation in which a jury with only two options, either convict of a capital crime or acquit, if the jury thinks he did not commit the capital crime, but he did commit a very serious crime, the jury would nonetheless convict him of the capital crime. So the third option of the lesser included offense was really designed to make sure that the conviction was factually reliable. In this case, he's seeking the opposite rule. He's seeking to take the factual reliability third option away from the jury. So he's actually, allowing a defendant to have an absolute veto right would fundamentally conflict with the reasoning of Beck because it would mean that he's taken away the factually reliable enhancing third option. With that, I see I'm out of time, so I will hand it over to the prosecutor, Ed Wynn.
Or Ed Pierce.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Edwin Pierce. I'm prosecuting attorney of Auglaize County, Ohio. And my purpose is just to add a couple things that were brought up by the court. First, the court has asked the question about whether in this particular case whether the judge stepped outside the bounds of instructing the jury. Of course, this is not a case about the abuse of discretion of the court. This is a proposition of law as to whether the defendant or the appellant in this case has the absolute right to reject lesser included offenses. Justice O'Donnell, you asked questions concerning trials. As appellant has argued, the state is the instrument that brings the case before the grand jury and submits counts or charges to the grand jury. And as you've aptly pointed out, many times as a case proceeds, that evidence changes. Trials are fluid. There are surprises that come up in trials. And that's why discretion is given to the trial judge to instruct based upon that evidence. In this case, in this particular case, as counsel's already pointed out, in opening, appellant's counsel made reference to whether or not there was penetration. But then in the cross-examination of the victim at page 245 and 246, he asked the victim whether there was lubricant used and questioned about forcing her legs apart to obtain this penetration and stated, this is the crux of the matter of this case, putting before the jury the issue of whether there was penetration or not. And that was in the evidence of this case. While it is true that the victim did not equivocate at all about her testimony, there was those questions asked of her and as whether there was lubricant and whether there was force used to separate her legs. Those were things that she indicated
counsel,
that she did not
know. Counsel, I
guess
if I understand your argument then, you're saying that it was all but conceded in this matter that there was contact and the issue remaining to be tried was conduct. Is that a fair analysis of what you're saying this morning?
That is what the state's case was. However, the appellant denied even being in the room.
You are the state, correct?
Yes. Okay. That was, but I thought you were talking about in the evidence in the whole. Yes. But the appellant denied even being in the room at the time this occurred. So my point is based upon the state of the evidence, both based upon the direct testimony of the victim and then later, as through cross-examination, there was this issue raised, and that's why the trial court gave the lesser-included offense of
Mr.
sexual
Pierce,
contact.
Mr. Pierce, as you know, we're not really concerned with the outcome of your case. We're going to write some law in this case that's going to apply to 730 judges across our state, and the issue of when and how lesser-includeds are submitted and whether or not the defendant has a veto power is really our issue. One of the cases that has been discussed in the briefs is the Clayton case, which from our court.
Yes.
Is it your opinion that we need to modify Clayton, or has Clayton given trial judges or counsel for either the state or the defense some indication that needs to be corrected in your view?
I believe the Clayton has been misread. I believe Clayton stands for exactly what Mr. Murphy indicated Clayton stands for, that the defendant can waive a lesser included offense, but it does not give them the veto power or the obstruction.
Do we need to reaffirm it or change it or just leave it alone, in your view?
I believe from a trial counsel's preference, we would like to see that it be changed so that that cannot be misinterpreted again as that, as in this case, that it is some sort of veto power or obstruction to a legitimate instruction by the trial court, whose duty is to make sure that a fair trial is provided and that justice prevails for both sides.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Counsel, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to indicate that, first of all, the state's position concerning our reliance on Beck is misplaced. Beck had to do with an Alabama law that did not allow lesser-includeds. It is, once again, our position that the court should not, on its own, give a lesser included offense, certainly without at least one or both sides asking for it. But it goes farther than that, and there are cases in Kansas and Oklahoma and Washington, Montana, that say it's the defendant's right to try his case, and it's the defendant's right to make that choice as to whether or not to have lesser.
Is your argument based on Clayton in part?
Absolutely.
And you read Clayton as saying that there is this right of the defendant to preclude a court from giving a lesser included instruction. Am I understanding your argument correctly?
Yes, Your Honor, you are.
And when you refer to Clayton, you mean footnote 2.
Absolutely.
Of Clayton.
Yes.
Okay.
Counsel, was your defense here that it never happened and he was never in the room?
Your Honor, once again, I didn't try the case, but yes, that was the defense that was presented at trial, that the defendant was not in the room, nothing ever happened, and the victim is the one, alleged victim is the one who...
How did that testimony be developed at trial? Did the defendant come in and say, I wasn't there?
That was the testimony at trial, yes.
Was not there?
Correct. Correct.
But there was also testimony, the video was introduced where he was making statements to another person that something may have happened, and the mother-in-law was not a liar.
Those statements were obviously so different and so many conflicting statements. At trial, the defendant said he didn't do it, he wasn't there, it didn't happen. And I understand there's conflicts, but the issue is really what should have been presented to the jury.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision, gentlemen. Thank you.